Six Music.
This is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
Today's guest on The First Dime is something of a rock legend. As a drummer, he's influenced countless artists, including the Foo Fighters, Metallica and Muse. And as a songwriter, he's written some of the jewels in the rock crown, including Radio Gaga and A Kind of Magic. He's a member of the most successful act of all time in the British charts, and he's no stranger to a 10-minute timpani solo. Queen's drummer, Roger Taylor. I spoke to Roger last year around the release of the remastered Greatest Hits, but this year also sees the reissue of Queen's first five albums, marking the start of a year of celebrations for the band's 40th anniversary, all of which makes it feel like a good time to look back on the life and career of one of the greatest groups of all time. Just one solution, one flash. When were you first aware of music, you personally? When did you first experience music?
Well, you know, like everybody else of my sort of era, I grew up listening to the radio. There was very little of interest on it for me as a child. A lot of Doris Day, and when that's, I suddenly heard Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets. I was probably about five, and I just six maybe, you know, and I just, what's this? It's like, these are aliens. This is fantastic. What's going on?
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4,
And then there was just the whole era of I suppose, James Dean, Elvis the Pelvis came along, and it was something else. Rock and roll was, and that's all I wanted to do.
And can you remember your first band? What were they like?
My first band, they were crap. They were not good. They were sort of really, everybody was trying to be the Shadows, or, you know, they were all instrumental bands in those days, and then the Beatles came along and sort of broke that mould, you know, but we weren't very good. Actually, my very first band, I played the ukulele, and I didn't know any chords, though, but I was very good rhythmically. They were called the Bubbling Over Boys.
The Bubbling Over, that's a pretty bad name.
It's a very bad name. It's a very bad band.
The first time you played with Brian May wasn't in Queen, though. There was a band before then, was there not?
It's a band called Smile that Brian and I started with another guy called Tim Staffel when we were both students at London University. He was at Imperial and I was at London Hospital Medical College. And we were a three-piece. We only lasted about 18 months and then we broke up, and our mate Freddie decided that he wanted to form a band with Brian and myself, and that was the beginning of Queen.
What were your first impressions of Freddie when you first met him? Can you remember that meeting?
I just remember meeting Freddie, yeah, and thinking, what a lovely guy. He's so keen on everything. And he was a huge Jimi Hendrix fan, which we were, so we had that in common. And he was lovely. And he was just a great guy.
She keeps him always Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cake, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. Job at Kennedy, at any time an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette, extraordinarily nice. She's a killer queen, gunpowder and gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try? She never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to gauge her mind. Then again, incidentally, she that way. Perfume came naturally from Paris. Naturally. Because she couldn't care less. Fastidious and precise. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class. You're absolutely right. She's got to get you. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try?
Killer Queen, I suppose, was your first proper hit, 1974. Had it, but it was like a whole two albums in. It was on the third record. Did that feel like?
It was three albums in, yeah. Actually. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, we'd had a hit with Seven Seas of Rye, but Killer Queen was our first, as you say, proper big hit. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Had it felt like a bit of a slog up until that point?
Yeah, it was a slog. It certainly wasn't overnight, and Yeah, I suppose it's about 3 years before we had a taste of success, really. But you just have to keep on going, and every little step you make seems like a big step, you know. And then we sort of felt, oh, we have sort of arrived with Killer Queen, yeah, because it was a big hit in America as well. So that was good, you know.
Bohemian Rhapsody is, I mean, one could talk for days just about the making of Bohemian Rhapsody and the cult of Bohemian Rhapsody and the whole thing. It's become this vast part of the popular music canon. It's just one of these immovable forces that never seems to end. Can you remember?
It does never seem to end. I know what you mean. It's very long.
When you'd finished recording it, which must have taken weeks and weeks, can you remember hearing it for the first time completely? Can you remember sitting there in the studio for the first time when you'd worked all the bits out and it was all on tape?
Oh, very well, actually. Our manager, who was John Reed at the time, who also managed Elton John, was there, and he said, you're mad. But he was blown away by it when he actually heard it. And said, you can't release that as a single. But then we sort of stuck to our guns and said, no, you know, we'll live or die by it. And we did release it. And obviously it was a hit. But it could have gone either way. You know, it was fairly extreme and it was fairly daring, I suppose, in those days, yeah.
Did you really think that it could have gone wrong? Because these days, as I say, it's so much part of the pop culture that it seems impossible that anyone wouldn't have appreciated it. Were there really worries in the camp before you put it out?
Well, really, it ran against all the things. It was too long to get on the radio, you know. It had different sections. It had a mock operatic section, and it was just breaking every rule there was, and you know that. So people do tend to think in sort of boxes in the music business, and it sort of burst out of all the boxes at once, and I don't know, but it was certainly the thing that sort of put us in another league, sort of globally, really, and we have very much to thank it for. Love it, personally. I think it's a wonderful song.
Of course it's a wonderful song. It's Bohemian Rhapsody. It's kind of difficult, you know, you can't have a go. It's an astonishing piece of work.
It's been very good to me.
Was it Kenny Everett was one of the first people to champion it on the radio?
He was, actually, yeah. Kenny Everett was like a really great mate of mine and a great friend with Freddie as well. And we sort of took it down to his place where he lived out in the Cotswolds one weekend before it was released. And he had his weekend shows, which were very listened to at the time, very influential shows. He was such a genius disc jockey. Oh, DJ, radio DJ. And he played it 14 times over two shows. So I think he was quite keen on it. And it sort of drilled it into his listeners. And it really was the beginning of the sort of takeoff of it. So we have a lot to thank dear Ken for.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Anyway the wind blows, doesn't really matter to me. Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead.
Back again this time. little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo, Galileo, Galileo
Figaro. Magnifico!
I'm just a poor boy and nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah!
No, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah!
We will not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Never let me go!
No.
Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia!
Mamma mia, let me go!
Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me! For me!
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. And the world, I'm turning inside out. I'm floating around in ecstasy, so
time. I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you wanna have a good time, just give me a call.
Don't stop me now.
I'm having a good time.
Don't stop me
yes,
now.
I'm having a good time. I don't wanna stop at all. La 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 la.
Don't Stop Me Now, more than, maybe not more than any other track, but certainly one of the standout tracks that's seemed to have had a life of its own.
Very much so.
Like in Shaun of the Dead, the Simon Pegg movie, it's used for that, and a whole new generation of people came to love it. Apparently it's the greatest driving record of all time, according to Jeremy Clarkson. it was used in that Cadbury's adverts quite recently. What is it about that track that just...
I don't know, do you know, it wasn't one of our favourite tracks. We never sort of held it in great regard. It was very much a Freddie thing, and... I mean, it was a song that we did, and it was a hit. It wasn't a giant hit, but it was it. And it became sort of more popular over the years. I don't know, it sort of filtered into the public consciousness somehow. And actually, I think it's a much better song than we've realised at the time. It's got a very melodic beginning and end as well.
You mentioned that Freddie liked it. Does that insinuate the rest of the band didn't? Did you have lots of creative arguments? Being all songwriters, that must have happened quite a lot.
We did have a lot of creative arguments, but I mean, we still just got on with it. I mean, with Don't Stop Me Now, we just, okay, fair enough. It's another song, you know. There were loads of arguments. I mean, real good stuff is born out of discussion and argument. And I think that was part of what made us a good team, you know. We were always banging our heads against one another's, you know, And there's a lot of discussion and argument, yeah. But without that, we would have been a diluted end product, I think.
It's something of an anomaly just having four very strong songwriters in one band anyway. I can't think of anyone else immediately. I mean, even the Beatles and Ringo's songwriting. Although I'd never, ever criticise Ringo as a drummer because he was amazing. But as a songwriter, not sure. Do you think that's one of the reasons why you have such great longevity?
I do, actually. I think the fact that there were four... we were very democratic. It really was a team, and we sort of shared everything, really. And it was very much teamwork, and one would support the other one when it came to writing a song, and Freddie was particularly supportive because he was undoubtedly the strongest writer at first. It was a great teamwork, and I think that is part of our strength. And, you know, there was no... Fred would always say, look, I'm not the leader of the band, I'm the singer. And he was the first one to always say that. And it was a great team, and I do think that's part of our longevity, really. You know, and let's face it, he's not even here. We're still going, in a sense, you know.
Another One Bites the Dust is one of the records that's... in your kind of mid-period, really established you in America again.
Mm.
The rumour is that you refused to spend much time in America until you'd had a big hit there.
Well, actually, it's a funny story, really. It turned out to be our biggest ever hit in America. It sold about 4 million, I think, just in America. But it was the third single, I think, from the Game album, and it was Michael Jackson's idea to release it. We didn't think it was a single. I certainly didn't, and I was completely wrong, obviously. But he came to some of our shows in LA, and he'd say several nights in a row, "You've got to release that track." Actually, he said, "You've got to release that track." But anyway, so we did, and he was right, and I was wrong, and we were wrong. And thank you, Michael.
It's just incredible that it's a funk song. It's a funk song by a rock band. That's what it is. To top the dance charts in America, that's an incredible achievement.
It was picked up by the R&B stations in New York. That's absolutely right. And I think they all thought we were like a black band, you know, like an R&B band. They all got a bit of a shock when it turned out to be these four white guys called Queen. But it was great. It was a great period for us in America. I remember everybody, you know, shouting on the street corners in New York, "You're bad! You guys, you're bad!" And that means we're good. Oh, great, you know.
Walks merrily down the street with the brim pool way down low. No sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip. For the sound of the beat, yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey. Hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
As if it needs saying, that was Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, the band's first ever US number one single. And you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Roger Taylor.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
Turned away from it all like a blind man.
sat on the fence, but it don't work. Keep coming up with love, but it's so slashed and torn.
Welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music, looking at some of the key first moments and songs from a musician's life. And today's subject is Queen drummer Roger Taylor. And you've just heard Under Pressure, the track Queen recorded with David Bowie in 1981. I asked Roger when he first met Bowie and how that song came about.
We were playing with Mott the Hoople at the Hammersmith Odeon, I think, and David turned up with Mick Jagger. That's probably the first time I met him, but we got to know each other very well, actually, and I think when we were in Switzerland, we were recording and he was living there. So he'd visit and we'd go out for dinners and stuff. And then one night we just sort of, we were jamming. We were playing old Cream songs in the studio. And then David said, well, why don't we write one? So we did. And we finished it off in New York. And I think personally, it's one of my favourites, actually, that of our stuff that we did. And David was absolutely vital to that, and he's such a brilliantly creative man.
It's wonderful, because I just had this image before, you know, listening to the song. I had this image of all of you out there, nightclub, somewhere massively glamorous and exciting, and just getting a bit smashed, and all of a sudden, why don't we go and do a song out of the blue, and just kind of it happening quite naturally.
Well, there was an element of that,
okay.
In it, yeah.
That's good to know. And it is, it's a staggering track. There's an incredible vocal performance, both from...
Yeah, they're both great, and I love David's a climactic sort of... The end of the record, I think, is a great piece of writing, actually, yeah.
Your light, my only friend. Through
Radio Gaga, one of your penned tracks, marked something of a renaissance for the band again. It was kind of, when it came out, it kind of saw renewed popularity internationally again. And you got the hand clapping.
Yeah.
When did you first see the audience doing that? Or was it intentional when you made the video to go, right, they'll love this. Everyone will love this. They'll be clapping. It'll be great.
Well, I suppose that really started with We Will Rock You. You know, that was conceived as a sort of audience participation song. It really was conceived, and it's what it turned out to be. And I suppose that was only really an add-on to Radio Gaga. I saw Radio Gaga as a sort of, look, we're in the 80s now, and everything was very modern and sort of electronic at the time. So it was my sort of a stab at being electronic and modern at the time, and it was also a bit of a comment on radio and the sort of dominance that video was sort of asserting over radio at the time, which I thought was probably a bit too much actually, and people were spending and paying more attention to video than they were to radio, and radio had always been a great part of our sort of growing up, and I just wanted it to assume its old importance. I suppose that's really the basic of the story behind it.
And of course, it was one of the highlights of Live Aid, which is regularly talked about as being your pumps being one of the greatest performances of all time that any band's ever done, ever.
Well, it was one of the shortest, anyway.
What was it like walking out on stage for that first song there? Because the pressure must have been, even for a band that had the experience that you had, must have been astonishing.
That's true, actually. I do actually remember being nervous. We weren't often that nervous, but, you know, we've been going quite a while. The sound on the stage, and it was such a sort of basic setup, and it was still daylight. The sound was terrible on stage, and so we were quite nervous, actually. You know, there were no lights to help you. And, you know, really it was bare. You know, it was going on pretty naked, but we just sort of really went through it by memory in a way, because it was sounded so awful on stage. We just sort of went out and belted it out. You know, 17 minutes of, I think six or seven songs, and you know, over 17 minutes. Yeah, it was all over in a flash.
And that once again, that once again marked. I used the word before, another renaissance for the band. It kind of introduced you to a new audience and made people that loved you before realise why they loved you so much. Had it been getting quite difficult before that point, had you kind of felt stuck in a rut to an extent?
I think you're very, very spot on, really. We were feeling a bit jaded, a bit tired. We'd done a lot of tours. We'd been around the world a lot. And we sort of thought, you know, we felt like quite an established older band by then, and we really needed a bit of adrenaline in our systems, and I suppose Live Aid reminded us that a lot of people really liked the band, and it was a wonderful sort of fillip for us, and it really reinvigorated us in a way. And I think we went back to Munich and we made some recordings, and it sort of gave us a bit of a new life thing. It was just a nice confidence booster. It was really great, actually. And it, of course, it was a wonderful day. And Bob Geldof, who's actually one of my closest friends, miserable old sod, you know, bless him. That was a wonderful achievement, which he should be eternally proud of.
It's a kind of magic. It's a kind of magic. A kind of magic. One dream, one soul, one prize, one gold, one golden glance of what should be. It's a kind of magic. The bell that rings inside your
You mentioned that it kind of renewed you with vigour, because off the back of that you had the Magic Tour, which is kind of, off the back of Kind of Magic, one of the biggest, most successful tours I think you ever did. You played Nebworth for the first time, which is an enormously successful gig. Did you know that towards the end of that, that Freddie was getting ill? Was that about the time that you first found out?
We were actually on, the Magic Tour was great. It was a wonderful tour. It was very successful. I mean, Nebworth was just stuck in at the end. We did a couple of Wembley stadiums and the ticket demand was so great. We stuck in a Nebworth, you know, on top of that. And even then we could probably have done another. It was, we were really on a high actually. And we just had faint suspicions that Freddie might not want to continue and it might be something to do with health. But really, he was on great form on that tour. And so I have great memories of the Magic Tour. Yeah, it was great. It was a very good tour.
Off the back of that, it seemed like you kind of shifted into a higher gear and started recording more and the albums came closer together. Was that a response to...
Well, I think when we realised, Freddie said, look, I'm not actually well enough to tour again. And I think we all realised that. And his prime wish was actually to work and keep working and as a unit. And of course, we were pretty tight. He felt most at home surrounded by us in the studio, which is a safe environment and away from prying eyes and you're doing work. So, and that's what he wanted to keep doing literally till he dropped and he couldn't do it anymore. And that's what he did. And we did. And it brought us very close. And actually, I think some of the stuff we did in that period is very, certainly very intense and very moving. I don't think it's all our best work, but some of it, there's some real highlights in there. And I did think that the last album we made really with Freddie's voice, Made in Heaven, was a very good album indeed, and Innuendo, the one before it, had some good moments as well.
Empty spaces. I guess we know the score. On and on. Does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime behind the curtain. Inside my heart is breaking, my makeup may be flaking,
Where were you when you found out, when you first found out he'd passed away?
We were in, well, we went over to his house and he felt he wanted to sort of formally tell us that, you know, he was sort of terminally ill. And, which he did, and was pretty grim, you know. And I think when we actually first found out, we were in Switzerland recording somewhere. And, yeah, it was all very grim and very, very sort of dark days. You know, we didn't want to lose our friend. And it took about 5 years to get over it when we did.
So after those 5 years, can you remember the first meeting when you sat down and thought, well, you know, there's, I think we have something more to say here?
Well, I suppose it was, I don't know, 18 months after he died that we had quite a lot of material, and we thought we'd be stupid not to finish the album that turned out to be Made in Heaven, which was, I think, a good album. And it was a real sort of landmark for us. It was a bit of a full stop, you know. And there's some very sort of emotional moments on that record. I think technically a good record as well.
Just finally, we've had, obviously, throughout the interview, we've had lots of firsts all the way through. So as for the last, what song shall we play now? What should we finish with? Your choice.
What should you finish with? That's interesting, yeah.
It could be one of yours. Give it an intro.
It's called The Unblinking Eye, / Everything is Broken, /
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
God would weep if he existed, and he saw what men can do to men. He'd think that we were twisted. His unblinking eye would blink, and then he'd say, not in my name you don't, you stupid little man, with your arrogance and ignorance, you do it time and time again. Yeah, I must be getting old. There's a fire and a fury driven deep into my soul. It's a helplessness that comes from being under your control. And everything is broken. 5 million cameras stare at us. You treat us like the fools. Our privacy is meaningless. We're suffocated by 10,000 rules. This kingdom. Just a complicated mess. Are we in Europe? Half in Europe? Not in Europe? We're soulless, spineless, directionless. And I must be getting old. There's a fire and a fury driven deep into my soul. It's the helplessness that comes from being under your control. And everything is broken.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
We'll be right back. This is BBC Radio
6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.
Until boulders turn to lead, then all the tales will be told whilst you and I are in the cold. But don't think this is the end, cause it's just begun, my friend. And when it's done, and all this is gone, just find a feeling, pass it on. For every tear cried in shame,